Greetings, dear, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm, open-arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. This episode is also brought to you by an app that I created called Still Believe. Still Believe transforms a picture in your home into video proof of your child's favorite magical characters. With the app, parents can catch the magic of the Tooth Fairy, leaving money under their children's pillow, or Santa delivering presents on Christmas Eve in their home. You download the app, take a picture, and we create the magic. We utilize feature film visual effects artists to transform your picture into video. Just tell your kids that you have a special app that can detect and capture the Tooth Fairy, then present them with the video proof in the morning. The look on their faces is priceless. Your Still Believe video is created in minutes, and you can then save it to your phone and share it on social media. The app is available for the iPhone and Android, and it's free to download. Our aim is to bring joy and wonder into the hearts of children around the world. Check it out at stillbelieve.co. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience. Today, I had the pleasure of talking with Amit Kapoor, and we discussed his article, GDP is Not a Measure of Human Well-Being. Very, very interesting. Amit has implemented a ease of living index in India that takes into account not just economic output, but society well-being into an index. And we talk about how Latin America and the EU is taking a similar approach and kind of the idea behind looking towards making people healthier and happier as opposed to just increasing economic output. I hope you all enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
that. Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks, we're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Man, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
Need to stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
They're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that
He was clipping his toenails at
harassment.
His desk. I can't take it anymore.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Working Experience. I have the pleasure today of talking with Amit Kapoor. We're going to discuss his latest article called GDP is Not a Measure of Human Well-Being. Amit, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. If you could introduce yourself to our listeners and give us a brief bio.
Thanks for this opportunity and getting me on the podcast. Very quickly, in fact, I chair the Institute for Competitiveness in India, an affiliate faculty for the Microeconomics of Competitiveness course at Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness. And edit a magazine called Thinkers, and then I extensively with on issue to export competitiveness, writing the roadmap for the competitiveness roadmap for the country, and then of course working on issues of ease of living and social progress.
Excellent. And how long have you been in that position?
So I've been chair of the Institute for Competitiveness since 2006. So I've been running the Institute for Competitiveness in India for the last 13 years as a chair, and that's what it is. So I have given the direction in terms of what the Institute needs to focus on. And the primary focus has actually been in the area of economic geography. So the idea was to really understand how geography matters for competitiveness, how we can actually make the country more competitive, more productive, and how we really need to take this place forward.
Excellent. Okay, so let's dive into the article, which myself and my co-host, Matt, had discussed on a previous podcast, and we found fascinating. So if you can give our listeners a brief overview and kind of like the idea and concept behind GDP not being a measure of human well-being, and you know, who is the intended audience? What message is was this a message intended for the Indian population, the world as a whole? If you could just comment on that.
So I'll start with your last question first. In terms of the very focus of this article, I predominantly believe that this article is focusing towards the policymakers and policymakers across the world. This is a debate which we need to have across the board. It is a debate in terms of understanding as to what GDP measures. Is it the right measure that we're really looking at? We have really moved forward in the world in the last 300 years since the whole GDP debate started happening in the 1600s, or measurement of output for an economy started happening in 1600s. But I think we right now at this stage, with the way the world is actually going, we have this whole huge rise of populist leaders and things. And if you really look at this thing as to why the populist leaders are actually happening across the world, is it an economic outcome or is it something else? So this is where the whole genesis of this piece is. In terms of understanding what is making this world go around, what are the challenges that we are facing, and why are those challenges actually happening today? Is it just about income inequality, or is it about something else as well? So what we are really seeing is that there is a huge level of disparity that is actually happening in the world. But at the end of the day, it is also about quality of life. People are disenchanted for a simple reason that they are not really getting what they ought to get. So this is a very important measure that we are really trying to say or suggest, that go beyond GDP, try to understand what matters for people, how to really make their lives better. Because at the end of the day, it is just not about money that matters. It's actually, or it's not the money that in your pocket matters. Because, and then of course, if you really look at GDP per se, GDP is a nice aggregate measure, if you really look at it, but it does not really talk about or does not dive deeper into understanding as to what is the disparity that exists. Like, if you have one person, if Bill Gates comes into the room, if we are two of us here and Bill Gates comes into the room, then suddenly the GDP per capita is going to be in billions for all of us. But that does not really give me any information as to what is the difference in income and how it actually affects me. So we need to get into measures which really tell about the quality of life. And this is where the genesis is. And if you really look at GDP per se as a measure as well, it's an important measure, but it misses a lot of points. It misses some amazing points in terms of saying as to what are the negative effects of things that are happening around us. If you really talk about the context in which I am living, say India, India is a growing economy from a GDP point of view, but we are missing a very important point here, and that is that the pollution that we are actually seeing right now. So what are the negative impacts of pollution? So if I actually have child mortality, which is high, what is the impact that actually happens? So we really need to instill a spirit of saying that how do we really measure many broad sets of things that actually matter in the world? And this is where this whole genesis of this piece is. And I hope, and my hope is that as a measure, we have across the world, we are able to move across to countries in terms of saying that we should measure quality of life or ease of living or what you might call a social progress. There could be so many words that can actually get used. So how do we measure those things? And it should become a movement across countries. Like GDP became a movement for countries in the 1950s. We need a similar movement right now in terms of saying as to how do we measure quality of life? How do we measure ease of living for people? And that's what it is all about.
Yeah, no, it's a very big issue and concept. And it's just, and it doesn't pertain... you know, the message is not just specific to India, specific to the entire world. In, I mean, here in the United States, it's, you know, the the society, the cultural story is succeed, make money, you know, get, you go to school, you go to college, you get a degree, you get a job, you get a well-paying job, you get a house, a white picket fence, and then a piece of paper is handed to you that you're supposed to be happy. And what we're finding in society is that is not the case. I know miserable people who are multimillionaires, like more money than you could conceive, and they're not happy. Yet we're, you know, the news cycle, we're tied to the stock market, and, you know, has the Dow gone up, the jobs report. I mean, all of this stuff to, you know, you have to take it into perspective. You know, someone who is on the brink of poverty earning $1 a day would love to have a job making, you know, $100 a day, or a job making $50,000. But and vice versa, they could be making a very subsistence living as a farmer and be extremely happy because they surround themselves with family and they have leisure time. And then you could take an investment banker here in New York who's making $5 million, who fills the void of his life with drugs and whatever have you, and he's miserable. So the real question is, will the policymakers take this to heart? You're almost trying to change not just a cultural story here in the U.S., but a cultural story maybe that we've even exported to the rest of the world, that, you know, growth and success will solve everyone's problems.
Oh, this is a very important point you're saying, you know. One, the world will have to change without a doubt, because if they don't change, there is going to be a challenge. If you really look at the world itself, to your point, there are two sets of things that we are really talking about. One is that whole idea of social objectives. The other one is about economic objectives. So when you say economic objectives, yes, you need to make a certain amount of money. I need some money to actually buy my goods and so on and so forth. But what about social objectives? And when you say social objectives, it's about how much time does it take for me to travel from place A to place B? What are the cultural things? How do I engage with people? What can I do with my time? Am I working 20 hours a day, or am I actually working 8 hours a day and I actually have a great life wherein I'm able to spend time with family, friends, and so on and so forth? I'm able to create experiences. So if you really look at it, the question is fairly big in terms of saying that how do I actually create experiences for myself? Because if I'm not able to create experiences, that means there is going to be a huge challenge in the world tomorrow. As you really look at it, from this whole social perspective, there are three broad elements from my point of view that need to be understood. And what are the basic needs that we need to really understand? Am I fulfilling the basic needs for people? There is so much of difference across the world. Very simple things like, say, shelter, water and sanitation, healthcare availability, or access to knowledge. There are kids who are not able to go to school in places like, say, Africa. And how do we solve that problem? The next thing is in terms of saying, what are the elements of welfare? And when you talk about elements of welfare, it is going to be a question of whether we are talking about economic empowerment. Am I enabling people to really do something on their own? What is the sustainable environment that we are really talking about? And the last but not the least, the important factor is going to be scope of human betterment. And that is really talking about things like inclusion or things like, say, access to higher education, because this is where, if you really look at it, inclusion becomes such an important element that we seem to be missing across in the world. Because when you say inclusion, it's talking about the whole idea of, say, tolerance. We are talking about, like, how tolerant am I actually to ideas? Today, what we are seeing in the world is that being in this whole movement of just trying to be politically correct, we have become tolerant to intolerance. And that is where we are actually seeing some amazing sets of wrongs that are actually happening here. In fact, I'll take a step back and I'll try to give an example of, say, United States. Like, a lot of people, I think it's become a favorite pastime of people to denigrate or ridicule President Trump. But have we ever realized, or have we ever looked at the idea as to why President Trump was elected? We have to understand it from a very deeper issue. And there are two very big things that have actually happened within the United States and across the world as well. So if you really look at President Trump's election in 2016, he was elected he was a popular leader in 2,400 counties of the 3,000 counties in the US. And why was he elected there? Because people were disenchanted with the present that existed and the present system of just growth and I'm going to, what I call, have higher incomes and so on and so forth. But there was nothing like, say, healthcare that was available. They were disenchanted with the services that were actually being made available and so on and so forth. So, and then there are 600 counties which were wherein he was not elected as a popular leader or whatever. He got lesser number of votes. But that is where a lot of people were actually making a lot of money. So that means there is something that is happening here in the broad sense that we need to understand. The second thing is, if you really look at it, GDP growth rate is an important measure, but it does not really tell me as to how growth rate of wages are actually happening. If you really look at the US figures, there's a very important figure that I would like to quote here. And that is, like, if you really look at, the real GDP has grown by about 350% from 1972. If you really look at, say, real wages, they have just been stagnated since 1970s. They have not really improved for people. So what we are saying here is that GDP as a measure is important. We are not really looking at as to what is happening to people, what is the disparity that is happening, what is happening to their quality of life, whether I'm able to give them those adequate services. If you really look at one of the biggest debates in the US is about, what you call as healthcare. And that's a similar story that is actually happening across the world. Today, in the world, you have 20-odd countries which have authoritarian leaders, if you might want to say, or the populist governments. And these are the governments which are actually hitting at a very interesting point. They're right center in political thinking and absolutely left of center on economic thinking. They're extreme left on economic thinking. They're saying, oh, we are going to create welfare and things. And that is what is driving all this, because people feel disenchanted in the world right now.
Yeah, no, it's very big points. And in the U.S., what we're finding, too, is everyone is identifying themselves on team. I'm on team Democrat. I'm on team Republican. And no matter what the argument, they are adamant about staying on their team. So compromise is out the door. Rhetoric is in the door. So it's, and healthcare is just a massive, massive problem. And you're right. People either love Trump or they vilify him here. Even if Trump, and I'm not a Trump fan or supporter, but even if Trump does something positive, people who dislike Trump will not acknowledge that. They'll just only see the negative aspects of him. His personality and his ego. And healthcare is just a massive, massive problem here in America. It's just, it's unaffordable to people. I think the statistics are 500,000 people go bankrupt every year from medical debts. It's just it's a mess. And if we can't, as a country, come together from both sides of the aisle and debate and compromise, we're lost, And the other thing that's scary about Trump is he's threatening the aspect of democracy, even though it's kind of held up pretty good, given the system in place. But Trump is questioning truth and facts, which is a very scary, precedent. You can't, a fact is a fact. A truth is a truth. It's not debatable.
Oh, without a doubt. I think when you're saying that this is a problem which is not unique to the United States, this is a problem that we are seeing across the world right now. Now, the whole, what do you call as the alternate truth syndrome, if you might want to actually say that. That everybody seemingly is thinking that the truth is just not there. It is a lie, or you're perpetuating a very interesting thing. Oh, this is a lie. This is a lie. And everybody starts believing this a certain fact to be a lie. So this is where it becomes very important that when you talk about economies today, you have to measure something like, say, education. You'll have to understand quality of education, because if we don't do that, then we are actually getting into the traps that you're really talking about. Because if I'm not giving people as a country, if we are not giving people the ability to think and ability to question and question everything that you actually have, we are going into a very interesting problematic situation. So this is what matters here. We have to really question. In fact, the other thing that we have to look at is, so there are some social things which are good, but they also create the negative side of the story. So the positive on social issues could be, say, if I have internet. Internet access gives me loads of information, loads of access to information, but it is also creating huge problems in terms of I only look at selective information. I have lost my capability as set of people to analyze, to really see through as to what is happening. So how do we measure all these sets of things? Because it is important for us, because if we are not able to reduce the effects or the negative effects of whatever is happening in the world, it's not going to be easy for us in the next 20 years. We might actually see the crumbling of the democratic processes, the crumbling of free will. Because today I see is that I already see that there is a crumbling of free will across the world. If you really look at countries like, say, Turkey, it was a beautiful country. It still is. But at the end of the day, look at the kind of leader that you actually have there and what is he doing. You also have authoritarian leaders like, say, President Putin. And then, of course, you have the Chinese example, which is, again, a very interesting example that there is a president for life who actually exists and there are no democratic answers there, or there is no democracy that functions. So that whole discontentment is also rising. So how do we really create measures which let us understand that we should not let all these things really pass into the world? Or how do we create a situation wherein we are able to create a much more just, humane society?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting what's going on with Hong Kong, because, Hong Kong was British controlled. It was a colony, and then it was handed over to China. And China was like, okay, you know, we're just going to let you guys do whatever you do. You know, you guys just keep on doing it. And then all of a sudden they were like, new set of rules. And the Hong Kong protests have risen up, and they are standing up for their freedoms. And, you know, it's getting very, very ugly. And you'll see the, they'll wave American flags. They're equating it back to when we were, when we fought for our independence. And this, what it comes down to is, with all these aspects, it's freedom. You know, when you have a leader that comes in and suppresses population, it's always going to move towards freedom. And it can be a very bumpy road, whether that's through protests, whether that's through war, but it will always come back to freedom. And you see that in places like Hong Kong. But and I think from, the question is, with all this stuff, is do leaders have the political courage to do things like that? I mean, presidents have been, speaking from the United States, presidents have been killed, JFK, for going against the powers that be, large corporations, other countries. For instance, let's take like a company like ExxonMobil. Okay. So ExxonMobil is a huge multinational company. It does tens of billions of dollars a year in revenue and employs hundreds of thousands of people. And I believe the U.S. government gives ExxonMobil hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies for one of the most profitable corporations in the world. And ExxonMobil, in turn, lobbies Congress to make sure those subsidies keep on coming. So if you look on ExxonMobil from a financial standpoint, you could say, oh, they're doing good. They're helping the economy grow. They're purchasing equipment. People are employed. That's great. But then you can also look on what's the environmental damage that ExxonMobil is doing that is not priced into that equation. Climate change, global warming, air pollution. You could use the same thing for large coal companies. And all of that stuff is not factored into the full equation. And to go against, for a politician to go against that grain is, I don't want to say impossible, but it takes a very rare individual to step up and say, you know, they'll do whatever, you know, like a Bernie Sanders, you know, he will go up against that grain, but there's no way he's going to get elected.
So I really do not know whether Bernie Sanders is going to get elected or not. That's the interesting thing. But to your point, it's a very important aspect that we need to understand. And this is the problem with GDP as well, that we do not really calculate or understand as to what is the negative impact of enterprises. Say, if you really talk about the economic activity that happens, like ExxonMobil, people are really going to drive cars and so on and so forth. And they're going to use their oil and things. But then we really do not calculate as to what's the negative impact on environment. In fact, within the Indian context, we have such huge pollution that is actually happening right now. We are seeing this huge, massive smog that has set in a place like, say, Delhi or the whole of North India. We live in India probably has, like, say, 10 of the worst polluted cities in the world out of the top 15. So why? And this is actually an outcome of a negative process. Like, we have agriculture. Yes, agriculture is great. We produce food. But the moment you actually burn stubble, that has a huge negative impact on environment. And we are really not calculating that. And this is the truth across the board. In fact, any enterprise for that matter, I really don't think it is just about ExxonMobil or it is just about coal enterprises. I think there is a derived effect of many enterprises. Say when you, simple thing like, say, plastic, and the kind of environmental damage plastic has caused to the world in the last 100 years is absolutely stunning. And then if you really, and since the advent of plastic, but then it did create a huge level of economic opportunity. It did create jobs, but we have not really understood as to what is the impact of those. I think what is happening right now is, if we really do not understand these things, we as human species are on the verge of extinction. In fact, I think this is where I would like to say something. Like, we have been so arrogant at points in time as species that we just simply think, oh, like, we can exploit everything and we can just run away with everything and we'll survive. But without a doubt, we are in the middle of one of the largest mass extinctions the world has actually seen. This is the sixth mass extinction that we're going through. And there is enough and more evidence to that is available from scientific journals and everything. So the question is that if we don't stop, we are actually creating a situation wherein we will not survive as a human race. And it becomes important that we actually measure these negative effects. And they're just far too large. If you really talk about enterprises like, say, Facebook of the world, I think everybody talks about manufacturers or enterprises like which are extracting things from the ground. But at the end of the day, we are not really talking about negative effects of Facebook's or the WhatsApp or the social media things, because they have actually become potent weapons in lives of for people across the world in terms of creating negative information. So it's become a negative cycle as well. So how do we set all this right? How do we create measures as to we know that what is going to be the economic or societal impact of things or decisions over a large period of time? The horizon will have to be 100 years or 200 years, and we need to learn how to calculate that. We need to understand as to where we are right now and where we want to be. Because if we don't do that, I think probably 10 generations from now, people are really going to have a very messy quality of life. They'll be struggling to survive as a species in the last 100 or 200 years. And the way the whole world is going, God forbid if there is a war, then what is going to be the catastrophic impact of those sets of things? And when I'm saying war, it is a nuclear war that I'm actually saying. So what happens there? And then, of course, when you talk about, say, leaders as well, I don't think India has also seen assassination of two of its favorite political leaders at certain points in time in history. They were the prime ministers and, of course, Mahatma Gandhi as well. But I think it's a situation which is very dangerous. It should not happen. But at the end of the day, I think you need people who are statesmen. You will need people who have the courage to fight. And they will have to bring that change. In fact, right now in the world, you have a 60-year-old girl who's trying to drive this whole idea of, say, something like sustainability. And she has that huge courage to really move forward. And that is where we need people to really stand up and fight for survival of us or for betterment of society and moving forward. And we need to really move ahead on measurement as well. And that is where it is. All of this is really a reflection of what has gone wrong with the economic system that we were actually having. And because this economic system has gone wrong in many ways, it has actually created that discontent. We need to find solutions in terms of, say, measurement itself and move forward with it. Because at the end of the day, corporations are, incidentally, changing their business models as well. So today, when you talk about corporations, there are large corporations that are saying, oh, we are going to create societal impact. We are going to create positive societal impact. In fact, mining companies, for that matter, who have always been trashed across the world, but today they are using technology. They are doing they're not sending people into the ground. You have technology to extract. And then, of course, they're extracting minerals. So the question is, everything is not bad, but the question is, what are the measures that we are actually doing? Because we need to also make the world move forward.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think there's a saying here, it's follow the money. You know, there's big money is integrated into the political system with lobbyists and entrenched into the way of life would continue profitability for that entity. So, you know, it's, you know, paper manufacturers fighting hemp. There is pharmaceutical companies fighting marijuana, you know, anything that's going to come in and display alcohol companies fighting marijuana, anything that's going to potentially come in and displace their revenue stream, they will go to lawmakers and say, oh, you can't do this. This has to be illegal. And then they contribute to their campaigns. And then it's a vicious cycle. And you're right. It's not just manufacturer and mining companies. Social media is having a huge impact on the psychology, especially of young people. There are, I can't remember the statistic, but when Instagram came out, the amount of young preteen girls that had that started cutting themselves increased by like 350%. And you can look at the chart and it's like, okay, this is when Instagram came on the market. And then the rate shot straight up because it's this constant curated comparison life that is not even real. It's Photoshopped. It's doctored. And, you know, people see that and then they become depressed with their life. And they're addicted to that feed. They're addicted to that, to the likes, and it's a vicious, vicious circle. Anyway, I want to get into the ease of living index. Can you explain the ease of living index and how it's calculated, how the idea sprang, and how it's currently working in India?
So you know, like this is John. This is an important question here. It started with this whole idea, like we were just talking about GDP and things, and we said, we need to measure something what matters for people. And what are the things that matter for people? And this is where we said, okay, now there are going to be three aspects which matter and that matter. That is, one is like clearly quality of life. And when you talk about quality of life, it is in terms of saying, what is the education level, what are the health infrastructure, what are the housing and shelter infrastructure that includes, recreational possibilities within cities or safety and security that matters for people, and mobility, well, how easy is it for me to move from one location to the other. The other aspect was economic ability. And this is where we were really trying to understand the economic robustness that actually exists. So like, what is the level of economic development that actually exists within a location? And when you talk about economic development is in terms of saying whether firms are interacting between each other or whether it is easy to start a firm and so on and so forth. And last but not the least was sustainability. And this is what is the most important aspect that we have to understand. And that was very clearly in terms of saying environment as a important aspect to really understand. And when you talk about environment, water quality, whether we are able to maintain water quality over a period of time, what is the tree cover that actually exists, whether I'm depleting my tree cover or not, and what is the pollution level, and then of course the green spaces, the energy consumption, what kind of energy I'm consuming, whether it is green energy, coal energy, and so on and so forth, and how quickly can we actually come out of disasters, can we build some resilience into our cities and our infrastructure. So these were the aspects that we are actually looking at for cities very clearly. And so this is an exercise wherein we are saying this becomes an important point in terms of understanding as to how cities get ranked within the Indian system. So we are talking about ranking 110 cities. We have already done that in one cohort in 2018. 2019, we are really looking at the data and trying to see as to how cities are really working on these, whether they maintain the tree cover or not, whether they've actually added the tree cover, whether there has been a negative effect of urbanization, economic development, and things. And all of these measures are outcome measures. These are not what you call input measures. So outcomes are a very important aspect that we have to look at. So if you really look at aspects like, say, child mortality, what are the exact numbers, what's happening? If you really talk about hospitals, what are the doctors per 100,000 people that are actually available? So what is the real measure that we have to really look at? And that is what we really looked here. And so this is a measure which is now getting used across cities. And now we are really taking it deeper into the level of districts as well. So the whole ease of living, a little more different construct from the city construct, wherein what we are saying is that how do I actually look at ease of living within districts in the country? And this is where we are saying we're going to look at 700 districts, 714 districts across the country, and see as to whether the quality of life has actually improved for people. And this has been a very important aspect for India. In fact, this is where I would like to appreciate our Prime Minister, who has actually said that ease of living is the thing that we need to measure. He says there are two things which matter for the country. One is ease of doing business, and the other one is ease of living. So I think this is where there is a statesman-like behavior that has become important. And this is what he's actually driving, that it says that how ease of living has to be measured. That is what we were entrusted with. And then if you really look at the district level, there were three measures. I did talk about it in the beginning of the podcast as well. What that was about: basic needs, elements of welfare, and scope of human betterment. And this becomes an important measure alongside the GDP. So there is this whole GDP growth that is happening, and then how ease of living is actually happening in certain locations. So quite interestingly, what we have found is that it is not necessary that if you have high GDP for a certain location, that ease of living is going to be, or quality of life is going to be very high there. Quite interestingly, say Delhi is one of the richest locations in the country from a per capita basis, but quality of life not so good, for a simple reason that pollution actually exists and so on and so forth. In fact, if you really talk about Kerala as a state in India or Himachal Pradesh as a state, they are economically not as robust as the other locations, but the quality of life in those locations is far better than in the location. So what we are saying is that, okay, now if I know that economics is driving something, but then quality of life is not driven by economics, it is driven by something else. So government will need to create interventions to really get that ease of living high, or improving the quality of life of people. And what are those interventions? I'm able to understand from this kind of a structure that as to what are the interventions that are actually required for people. And if you really look at this whole measure or a metric, this is so easily replicable across the world. Any country for that matter can actually do it. So we were inspired. In fact, I have worked on the Social Progress Index, and we were inspired by this body of work, and we actually created something for India inspired by the Social Progress Index. What we have seen is that Social Progress Index has actually got implemented in Latin America. We are seeing that whole huge measurement happening in European Union. So the EU has actually accepted that as a measure. So what we are seeing is there is a movement of sorts wherein countries are actually accepting this measurement as an idea. So what we will see in the future is that we are going to see economic measurement like, say, GDP, and then of course we are going to see ease of living, quality of life, or social progress as a measurement, which is going to happen. And then we are going to see as to how they come together. Is there a point of departure? If there is a point of departure, then in between these two things, then what are the interventions that we need to actually do and require? And this is all based on hard data, hard facts. It is not an opinion-based thing, because opinions can actually skew the whole thinking on this. So we have to look at hard measures and really take things forward from there.
And so how do you aggregate the data for the Ease of Living Index? And then what is the index? Is it a numerical value? Is it from 0 to 100, 0 to 10? If you can comment on that.
Oh, so the index is 0 to 100. So that's where it is. It's a numerical value that actually comes out. Now, in fact, the whole numerical value will tell you as to where do you stand, how far you are from the utopia as well. In fact, what we've also done here is that we have tagged it. So we know as to if my utopia is SDG, how far am I from the utopia of, say, SDGs as well? Assuming that's the utopia until 2030, we want to be much better than that. But at least I know as to what is my distance from what we really want to be in 2030. It also gives me a very important understanding as to how far am I from there, how much time is going to take me to really get there to achieving those SDG goals. So it's a numeric number, very clearly. In fact, anybody who's a district head or a city head can actually look at a scorecard, and he knows as to what are the problems, what are the challenges, and what are the interventions that are actually required immediately. And quite interestingly, what India is doing is that this is going to be a measure which is going to happen on a yearly basis. Yearly basis, we'll make it public as a country, but then we, as and when we get the data, we are in a position to update this whole index. So people are able to see as to what is the delta effect, how things are changing for them. So this is an important element that is actually happening right now in India.
Great. And that index is open to the public. Like the public could go to, like, I'm assuming, like a website and see where Mumbai rates or New Delhi or things of that nature.
Absolutely. It's open to public. It's an open platform. It is it is a public good.
And now, are you finding that politicians within these provinces, which is Mumbai, New Delhi, are using this to attract people to their city? I mean, we see this in there's no Ease of Living Index here in the U.S., but they will occasionally publish, like, oh, come to Austin or Chicago or L.A., and then they'll rate, like, commute and average cost of home. You know, they'll do a whole set of or schools or whatever, and then they'll use that almost as marketing copy to get people to come to their city. In fact, some cities pay people. I think it's Boise, Idaho, is paying people $10,000 to come to their city, which is crazy.
Oh, so in India, we are not paying, but we are already seeing evidence that states are saying, or cities are saying, oh, that, yes, we have a great quality of life. We are improving, and why don't you actually move in? And that is what is happening. So this is a very important aspect that we have seen. In fact, there is a whole idea of comparative federalism that has happened in India. And that comparative federalism is that how states are, can actually be better from each other, or even what you call as how cities can be better from each other, or what is it that they're doing better. And that has actually become a very important proposition. So states are now saying, or cities are saying, I'm a better location for XYZ. Why don't you actually come in? And we are seeing that there is a movement within people in terms of saying, oh, I want to go to a location which provides me a better quality of life or ease of living, and I'll move there. And we already see that evidence in many interesting ways.
And now, so is the world taking notice? You mentioned Latin America and some European countries. I know there's Bhutan had the gross national happiness index. Massive economies like the U.S., China, Japan. I mean, India is a massive economy. Has any of these really, really large economies, like, has the EU did it, or was it just specific countries within the European Union?
Well, so European Union has adopted the Social Progress Index.
Okay, great.
So that's what is happening right now. So we are already seeing evidence that more and more people are talking about ease of living, because they understand that social objectives, or meeting social objectives, is going to be very critical or super critical in the future. for a great politician, assuming that politician has to survive, he has to come back, he has to get reelected, it is not only going to be about economic growth, it is going to be about ease of living as well. You could use a different term for ease of living, but it would become one of the most important aspects as you go along.
Yeah, I know it's very interesting. And obviously for, you know, healthcare, social mobility, jobs, happiness, you know, that's all very, you know, centralized local issues within your country. But when you take an issue like climate change, which is, you know, it's essentially everyone's problem, right? You can have local problems, like you mentioned, like the smog in New Delhi, but then you have global problems, right? So if a country is burning massive amounts of coal or sending out massive amounts of CO2, that could affect another country generating a more powerful storm because the oceans are warmer. Like right now I'm in New York, we're experiencing an Arctic blast because the jet stream that normally holds that Arctic air up in the Arctic Circle has become weakened and loosened, so that Arctic air has poured down, I mean, all the way to Texas. I think it's like 30 degrees in Texas, wow, which is below freezing. Okay. And that's a cause of climate change, of global warming, because the oceans are getting warmer and it's affecting the jet stream. It's like a domino effect. So it's really imperative that all nations come together. And I guess that's, you know, what the Paris Accord is trying to do. But everyone comes together and we agree on, okay, we've got to lessen these emissions. We have to, we have to go long on solar energy. We have to eradicate plastic. You know, there's a laundry list of things that we have to do, but that's a very difficult thing to do because you're dealing with nation states with different objectives, and does it serve them to do so? It becomes very difficult.
Oh, even like GDP was something which was non-existent as a measure until about when UN said we are going to be using it as a measure in 1940s or probably late 40s or early 50s. If you really look at it, like, I think quality of life, ease of living, social progress would become a very important measure across the world in years to come. Because I think we are going to be talking about economic numbers, GDP growth rates, and we are going to talk about change in my ease of living scores in the same breath over a period of time. These are going to be two measures which are going to be talked about in the same breath. You cannot do away with GDP. It's a great measure. It's an important measure. But as this is an additive measure, it's going to be super important and critical. And we would see that both of them would actually move forward in years to come. I think this is going to be one of the most important aspects in the next 10 years. In fact, you had people like Joe Stiglitz, like who's a Nobel laureate, who's talked about all this. You've had great authors like Thomas Piketty as well, who are talking about it. And it has taken a political life of its own. And this is part of the important debate that the world has to really go on. And it is really going to be a movement that nobody will be able to stop in the future, because I think people are becoming aware.
Excellent. Okay, we're almost done here. We're coming down to the final stretch. So let me see how I can phrase this question. So what would you want the future to look like, just not in India, but around the world? Like, let's fast forward 20 years from now. Okay, let's go to 2040. How do you see the ease of living index, social progress? You know, what's the best case scenario?
Oh, I think I would like to see a world in 2040, in say 20 years, wherein people are saying that, yes, my quality of life has actually improved across the board. The difference between countries has actually substantially reduced. I think this whole enigma of, say, immigration that happens because people are enamored by a certain location. If I'm able to do that in my local level or a local region itself, then people are going to be there. They're going to contribute to systems in that certain location or a geography. So I would see a world wherein the quality of life or the difference between quality of life across the world is substantially reduced. Probably a very tall order, but I would like to see that. It might not happen in 2040. It could take another 50 years to be there. But I think we should be able to do that. And it is an important aspect that people start looking at it, because it's about survival of us as species, because that's a very critical factor that I believe. And that is what is going to happen.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us. And if our listeners wanted to find out more information about you or the Ease of Living Index or get more involved, where can they, do you have a web address, social media?
Oh, so if anybody wants to look at my body of work, they can look at two locations. Like, I have my personal website at www.amitkapoor.com or my institutional website that is competitiveness.in. They can follow me on Twitter at Kautilya, Kautilya. And that's where it is. And they can always get back to me on email, which is amit@amitkapoor.com if they want to. And would love to respond if somebody wants to get it. And of course, one more thing, if they want to read my books, they're available at Amazon, and my two new books and documentaries are also going to be out. So my two books on competitiveness and another one on democracies is going to be out in the next 18 months. And then, of course, I've done a few documentaries and I've written the scripts for those. So they're all, one of them is out and another three are going to be out in the next 12 months. So hopefully you're able to get engaged with those.
Excellent. So we'll have all that information in the show notes. And Amit, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with us about the important work that's going on within India with the Ease of Living Index and social progress. And we hope leaders in large countries implement this and we all are smiling in 2040. Actually, some of us will be pretty old by then, but our children and grandchildren, the next generation. So thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. And Amit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media and the Still Believe app, the only app that delivers video proof of the Tooth Fairy and Santa by simply taking a picture. Download the app at stillbelieve.co today and amaze your kids. And if you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.